Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. Back again on another Monday as we are 52 weeks of the year. The only rugby podcast here for you every week without fail, even when we're on honeymoons or impaled on trees and recovering in hospital. We're there for you all the time. Abroad, JB, hello. The aforementioned impaled star of this podcast. Once impaled.
Rather known as the impaler, but I'll be known as the impaled. Hello, Tim. How are you?
Very well. And Phil, how are you doing? Whereabouts in North Yorkshire are you then?
Hello. Hello, Tim. Hello, JB. I've taken my Egg Chasers branded shipping container to a very small village in the North York Moors, very small village called Staunton, which the nearest bigger village is Huttonley Hole, if you've ever heard of that.
Nope.
Neither had I. But it's very nice. There's lots and lots of sheep and some nice hills as well.
Very nice.
There is lots and lots to talk about. Firstly, you can find us at Rugby Podcast in the cesspit on Twitter, where @JBeardmore, JB is lurking. I don't really tweet very much anymore, but occasionally I might chip in @Cocker. Phil is lurking. But one thing has dominated newspapers, the ones that were allowed to be printed and got out to their readers, and on websites, blogs, and no doubt on podcasts, including this one. Let's just go straight in on Owen Farrell. And I tell you what, let's all just watch the clip for a second and remind ourselves of what happened. Here we go.
The final on in again. Andy A.
There he is. So Owen Farrell comes in. Charlie Atkinson.
Send the dressing edge off. Get him off the field.
Clothesline.
Get him off the field.
And
that's just typical what it is.
Commentator on BT Sport, understandably not happy. What do you make of this one then? What do you make of this? And what do you make of the reaction to this tackle?
Well, I don't really know that much of the actual reaction. I've only been on Twitter for like five minutes. I mean, I've been away all weekend. I've like Phil, I went to Abersoch. Well, not like Phil, I didn't go to Abersoch, but I went away. So I've been kind of off the social media. So I don't really know much about the reaction other than to say, if Andy Goode was to come out and say, there's nothing to see here, everyone move on, everybody who doesn't like Andy Goode would then start saying, oh, it's a lifetime ban. And if Andy Goode said it's a lifetime ban, everyone who doesn't like Andy Goode would then go exactly the opposite way. So I don't think you can actually tell anything about the reaction on Twitter because it has nothing to do with what actually happened. It's like, which political camp are you in? And then we'll go from there. But the event itself, I think it's actually, the actual split second is very, very simple. It's a horrific tackle. I mean, I think it's one of the worst tackles I've seen in professional rugby of late. And the reason I say of late is because there's so many things discouraging behaviour like this that the landscape has changed. So when you do see it, it is particularly jarring. But I think leading up to it, there is a lot more going on behind the scenes here. Owen Farrell's not played for 6 months. He's incredibly rusty. I think he tackles naturally high anyway. I think he was tackling high all game. It was an accident waiting to happen. And although this might not be the worst hit he's ever put in, it's probably the worst outcome that he's ever had. So, it's not quite as simple as saying, he's evil and wanted someone to die. That said, I think it's a very, very serious tackle. Very serious.
I would echo that. It is a very serious tackle. And I would also, I think your kind of the reasons leading up to the tackle in that Owen Farrell often tackles high, that is definitely true. And he's been lucky for it not to have cost Saracens and England's games in the past, actually.
Yeah.
The most notable one that springs to mind is the tackle against André Esterhazen, England versus the Springboks, 18 months ago, I think it was, in the Autumn Internationals, where he could have lost England the game. It was the last play of the game. It was that one was arguably a no-arms tackle. Fortunately, the guy he was tackling was 6'4", not 5'8", and so he didn't take his head off in that situation. But it does feel like Owen Farrell has been a ticking time bomb for something like this.
Yeah.
And I really hope Charlie Atkinson is okay, because it was a hell of a hit. But I also hope that this is a learning point for Owen Farrell, because he needs to get tackle lower. He has to. It's too much of a risk. Particularly, he does rush into the line and he does try and put in big hits. And that combined with the tackle height, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I might be suffering from confirmation bias here, but I watched the game knowing Owen Farrell had been sent off. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for things, actually, which would give me clues as to, you know, is he being reckless all game? And I did think, actually, he's got two hits on Le Bourgeois where he is absolutely bang upright and he hits him hard. And it's fine because Le Bourgeois stays upright. Same as Esterhazen. Esterhazen stays upright. If Esterhazen ducked into contact, that would be a horrific outcome.
Equally, that would, in the eyes of the law, be a mitigating factor, potentially.
Yeah.
Potentially, yeah. A sudden change in height is a mitigating factor.
I agree broadly with what you guys have said. I would just want to pitch in with one additional element, which is more to do with the way that this is characterised afterwards. I took a little screenshot of your favourite newspaper, JB, Wales Online.
Oh, yeah. Why can't they protest Wales Online? I mean, that's real fake news.
Yeah. The headline, Owen Farrell sent off for horrific red card incident that should see him banned for a long time. Which, that's going beyond, you know, stating facts. That's getting into the realms of an opinion piece for news there. But then what I did like was the line underneath, which said, video footage captures Farrell's high tackle on Charlie Atkinson. It's like, well, yeah, it was on telly.
Video footage. Spycam exclusive.
Yeah. But yeah, what I would say in terms of the reaction is, I like those sort of those philosophical, call them razors, and the Hanlon's razor, which is just a philosophical mindset, which that one in particular, we should all apply to our lives all the time, because it is, I'll get the word slightly wrong, but never attribute malice something which is better explained by stupidity.
Yes. Yeah, that's how I understand Hanlon's razor.
Yeah, and this is a prime example of that. It was stupid. Yes, you can use that word, reckless, but the number of people, and I think it's a triangulation of anti-English sentiment. I think it's anti-Saracen sentiment, and just maybe anti-rugby league, or maybe just anti-Owen Farrell. I don't know, but there's a triangulation of all those things, which meant that it's been characterised as him being a dirty player, him having premeditated, him having tried to take his head off with a stiff arm. It was just a rubbish tackle. And we have to remember, one of the things we love about rugby is the threat of danger, and that accidents can and do happen. They should be avoided where they can, but they can't always be. And this was an accident for which Owen Farrell, no one's going to pay a higher price than Owen Farrell. Hopefully Charlie Atkinson's okay.
Yes.
He's going to miss some massive games. But for calls to him to be, oh, England should drop him, do one.
England should react appropriately in accordance with whatever ban he has.
Yeah.
He's not available for 10 weeks, he's not available for 10 weeks. And if they tell me he's going to get 10 weeks, I would say, yeah, fine, okay. I think that's reasonable. I think it'd be harsher than previous red cards. But then I think
That feels a lot. But
I also have to say this. I am coloured in my opinion of Owen Farrell, of what I already think of how he tackles. Mm. And also, I am holding him to quite a high standard here, because I do think that when you are the England captain, and you're as good as you are, and you know you have a propensity to tackle high, and you know you're rusty, I'm just surprised he didn't make even more of an effort to go low. But those aren't legal things. Those aren't things which no. he should be charged with, or no. you know, should be added to his sentence, whatever that sentence may be. But yeah, that's kind of where I am. That's why I find it a little bit more jarring. And I think someone mentioned, this is an astonishing thing to say. Someone mentioned that the nanny hit on Johnny May was worse. And the reason being it's worse is because it was contact, it wasn't a flailing arm, it was shoulder with the head, the actual physical contact might have been greater. And I just think, you can't, A, compare events like that, and B, it's not really about the initial contact, is it? I mean, the initial contact's one thing, but what about the way that the player falls to the floor? I thought that was far more sickening than the actual hit itself. I mean, there's other players out there who could have ridden that hit.
Yeah. What I would say is one of the worst tackles I've seen in the Premiership, if you want to confine it to recent seasons, was one on Faf de Klerk on I think it was an Exeter forward, but it just had no impact. But it was just it was shoulder to head, and had it been a reversal and been someone like Don Armand on Faf de Klerk, it would have been an outrageous hit. So there are context specific elements here. We see it all the time where. Massive guys put in huge hits. And what, Alassana Tuolangi in that World Cup?
I mean, just to highlight how stupid that these comments are, which are, just because I have seen harder hits with shoulders to heads, right? If I hit someone personally, and they fall to the floor, hit their head and die, right? And then Mike Tyson hits someone and they don't die. The punch that I threw, although significantly less hard than Mike Tyson's punch, is still more serious. Like, the initial impact of the hit is not how you categorise the seriousness of it. It might be an element, but it's not it's not the whole thing. It's the fact that Charlie Atkinson was so badly hurt. And when there's a guy on the floor having his head and neck examined whilst regaining consciousness, in my mind, that is the most serious type of rugby offence. And there you go. The only way it'd be more serious is if it was, actual foul. I mean, you could argue it is foul play, but the kind of foul play I mean, resulted from punching or kicking or that kind of thing.
Yeah, deliberate is... because Owen Farrell, it was reckless in line with the law. It was not deliberate. And you can see Owen Farrell's reaction when... Like, the second he's done it, he massively knows he's cocked up. And he rolls on the floor and puts his hand up because he knows that he is going to be facing a long ban. And probably, not more than that, he's... potentially seriously hurt one of his fellow professionals.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, it really shows character of the man when he apologised and said straight away, "I'm really sorry for messing up the Leinster game." It gives you a measure of the man.
Get the excuses in.
He didn't say that.
It's just, do you know what? We talked about what would the Hollywood movie, what would have to happen for Saracens to become a Hollywood movie? This is just another little step on the way to a Hollywood script being written.
Yeah. Now, just on this game, unless anyone else has got anything to say about Owen Farrell?
I'll just say one general thing. Yep. Calm down.
Yeah.
Calm down. It's all right. It's okay. Hopefully Charlie Atkinson's okay, but calm down, because this will happen again. It will happen to a player that you love and that you think is amazing right now. It might not happen to a player who you kind of love to hate. And when it does, I'll say the same again. Calm down.
Maybe... this is, as JB kind of hinted at before, this is a sign of just how far we've come. That, and I might be totally distorting things, but in my head, 20 years ago, that kind of tackle, it would not have happened every game, but there might have been one every other week of that kind of tackle.
Yeah.
Now it's this, I can't remember another one like this for the last, say, 2 years or very,
and,
very.
And you know, something I've not seen since the restart really is anyone flying in knee height at someone at a breakdown that could, Sam Jones's career ended aged, 25, 26?
Yeah.
When he was in the England squad. There hasn't been a hit like that. If you watch the Lions video of 97, Doddy Weir getting stamped on and his ligaments in his knee going, there's been nothing like that since the restart. So you know, accidents do happen in rugby, and that is one of the things we love about it. So let's just keep a little bit of perspective when it happens. Owen Farrell made a stupid tackle, and he's going to be licking his wounds for quite a while.
Yeah, we do have phenomenally disciplined professionals in rugby. It has to be said. But of course, we're talking about Owen Farrell, and we shouldn't be. We should be talking about Wasps, because you know, coming off the back of the Bath victory, which I thought was wonderful,
heroic.
This was incredible, and the worst thing about the Owen Farrell here is we're not talking enough about Wasps. I honestly think these are two of the best results back to back in recent Premiership history. They are phenomenal. Now, we do have to caveat that, because it's not entirely fair that you talk about Wasps without talking about their recruitments, because I think they enjoy an advantage that no one else does. So, like, Tim Cardle, they got him for big money. What's he, like, All Black 40 caps? Tom Cruise, where did he come from? Beerits, and I think he had won a title with Toulouse. You know, they're doing this with lads that you basically don't know of. I thought, is it not Ben Harris? Who was the guy on the...
Ben Morris.
He had a phenomenal game. Just roughing up Jackson Ray. Where's he from?
Is he an academy guy? Or is he another championship signing?
No, he's 28. He's 28. He's from Nottingham Rugby Club. Tim Cardle's only 6'4" from Nottingham Rugby Club.
And Ben Morris was replacing Alex Reader, who they picked up from Rotherham and who had to retire.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. This is an absolute triumph of coaching, because when I'm watching Wasps, what I'm seeing now is a team who are incredibly calm. They're incredibly collected. They don't seem to have highs and lows. They just seem to, you know, stay steady. And it's that steadiness and that confidence in what they're doing, which allows them occasionally to open up. I mean, they're playing with such confidence.
One moment highlighted it for me. So I was working at the Quinns Bath game, and I was just watching a bit of the first half on my phone. And it was just before half time, and Wasps were up 9-7, something like that. They just defended on their own line, managed to win a penalty. The clock's going into the red. 9-7 up against Saracens, having just defended your line. Most teams would tap, kick into touch, go in at half-time. Ben Vellacott tapped, went, and 30 seconds later, they won another penalty, and they go in 12-7 up. And I think that said to me everything about the attitude of Wasps, the confidence that they have got in what they're doing, exactly what you're saying, that they're like, no, we're not happy 9-7 away at Saracens. We want more.
I can't understand. I just don't understand. I mean, yeah, you say it's confidence. I don't know what it is. I mean, is it a fact that all these boys are terrified of going back to the championship? So, you know, we better play pretty hard. But there again, they're beating like Vincent Cott, World Cup winner, Jamie George, World Cup finalist, the great Mauro Toji. Arguably, you could say they frustrated Owen Farrell so much that he resorted to do what he did. Maitland International, Barrett International, Elliot Daly International, Alex Goode. And these guys, I mean, I'm not being funny. Paolo Odogwu was spending most of his time playing for Sale FC. And look at him now. Le Bourgeois, Bedford. Bassett was Bedford. It's absolutely incredible.
So one point just to make on the way that Wasps played. And Tim, I think your example with Vellacott is a really good one, because it shows their... not afraid, and they've like you said, they've got the confidence to do the right thing when it's on, but they've also got the calm head when Jimmy Goppus is controlling the game. They've got the calm heads to know when it's not on and just identify space and put it in deep and then defend as a team. And that actually, conversely, when you watched the game where they lost against Sale's second team at Hota de Rico 2 weeks ago or three games ago, they didn't necessarily have that. They believed they were the better team at that time and were trying everything all the time, and it just was repeatedly not working, rather than controlling it, taking a step back, get the field position and build from there. And so that was a really impressive thing that they did in this game. But when it was on, it was on.
Yeah, can I tell you one of the most impressive things that I saw in this game? And you might have noticed it, you might not have. But I thought it was really, really smart. By the way, Wasps are winning these games without a scrum, which is even more amazing.
I know, like against Bath, they had no line out and they managed to just work around that. With this, they were getting pumped in the scrum and they managed to work around that. And
Yeah, bad news, boys. We've got no money, no scrum, no line-out. It's incredible. It's like, so Tom Willis has the ball, and he is about to place the ball back. But if he places the ball back, and it's after a scrum, so obviously they've just been absolutely pummeled. If he places the ball back, he'll have to place it over the dead ball, not over the dead ball line, over the try line. Into
means
the
there's no offside line, and Saracens can run around and tap it down. So or concede a 5 meter scrum, yeah.
Yeah, so he is on the he's on the deck, and he's got like maybe 2 or 3 inches to work with. His mates come in, blow over the top of the ruck, maybe give him a couple more inches to work with, and only at that point does he put down the ball. And I thought, you've got to have something about you when you're getting absolutely pummeled in the scrum. You picked it up, you want to present, he's trying as hard as not to present, he's got the ref saying play it, and then he's got to wait for his mates to come over, just give him that tiny, tiny fraction, and then he plays, and then they exit. I thought, you know, that is quite something.
Young men, old heads. And he's a classy operator, that Tom Willis. He's not quite the physical specimen that Jack is, but as like a smooth footballer, he looks really nice.
Yeah, and Ben Morris too, like, just to go back to him.
You're on mute, Phil. There you go.
Like, just to go back to the bravery point. Like, Ben Morris is at a ruck in the Saracens 5 metre. I mean, you know... I have to be careful how I say this, so I don't want to sound disparaging towards him, but he's 28 and he's from Nottingham. And, you know, you want to make sure you don't make any mistakes whatsoever. He just picks up the ball and goes. Just no fear.
How old my brother was when he went from Nottingham to London Irish.
He did have a stint at Sale first.
Oh, he did. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I want to know how far these guys can go. If you're a Bath scout, right? Bath, who like their big players. Just imagine this. And he went to the Rico to scout this team. You know, let's pretend that they were not coached the way that they were. Which name here would be on your scouting sheet? Who would you actually want? Because you would argue maybe none of them.
Well, it depends what you're going. If you're going on just star power alone, or you're going on performance.
Star power.
Star power. Gopeth? De Jong, maybe. If it's just star power, De Jong.
Will Rowlands, I think, is like a miniature Simon Shaw.
Yeah, he's a good player. Will Rowlands.
Well, they've got Leicester at home midweek, and then they play. They've got a big game at the weekend, I think. I can't remember who. Is it another team that's in the top four?
Bristol.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, it's Bristol. Yeah, so they've got a big week. But they if they get that win at home at Leicester, they're rolling. And now the top four is going to come from five teams. Well, the second, third, and fourth is going to come from four teams, and it could legitimately be any of them. It's brilliant. But let's come back to the Premiership, because one of the other really, really impressive performances of the weekend, I think we should touch upon early doors, because it was such a significant game. Phil, just high pride, are you?
Oh my God!
Stand up for the Ulstermen.
Yeah. So, kind of being away, I wasn't watching this game live, but I was following it live. And having followed it in that first half and the first 20 minutes of that second half, I thought it was game over. So Edinburgh, by far the better team for 60 minutes. And to be 12 points up at home and comfortably up at that point, I thought it was done. I was certain it was done. And the two tries, the two driving maul tries, and the two incredible Madigan kicks were... It's just an unbelievable comeback.
And it's in his veins.
Oh, my God. To slot those who could... Neither one. One was from the touchline, the wrong touchline for a right-footed kicker. And then... 45 metres out on the 15. Two incredibly difficult kicks with no pressure on you. And then when you put that pressure on, it's just remarkable. And I really was not expecting this. I wasn't expecting it going into the game. I certainly wasn't expecting it with 17 or 18 minutes left when you're 12 points down. It really was a remarkable performance. And the most surprising thing is to do it against Edinburgh, because Edinburgh have been such a good team this year. They have been the second best team in the Pro 14, and they've arguably deserved to be in that final to get their shot against Leinster. But I will take it. I'll take it all day long. Now, unfortunately, it does mean a shot against Leinster, and I simply cannot see any way on earth that Ulster are going to win. But if we knew the score, we wouldn't watch the game.
Exactly. Just on Ian Madigan, it's a funny thing, isn't it? When he left Ireland, he was 25, and you know, now he's back kicking sticks. I mean, I've got to say, he doesn't look a sprightly 31. And I find it hard to believe that once upon a time he played international 12. But he did. I wonder if he can carry on kicking as well as he does and maybe find some form, if he'll ever be considered for Ireland again.
Good question. The man I'd like to see who's a very smart all-round operator is Billy Byrne.
He is, isn't he? And been never smart all-round operator in England.
He was certainly not considered good enough at the higher level in England. But I'd love to see him be given a proper shot.
Yeah, agreed. I would as well.
There is a line to draw between Wasps and Ulster, and that is just the way that they manage to win when they shouldn't win. Exactly as you said, Phil. And it just feels there's a sense of a. Oh, I'm trying to think of the word. I don't know. There's a certain energy within the squad that they seem to just dig really deep for each other. And Dan McFarlane, I've talked many times in the podcast when I've been over to Belfast and watched games. I love the cut of his jib and the way he talks. And he has this little mantra that he's been using for years now, fighting for every inch. Mm. And Ulster put up a little video that I saw on their Twitter channel, and of that Billy Byrne's interception. When for all the money, it looked like Edinburgh was streaking away. Was it Iron Do doing more Iron Do things? Yes. And all he had to do was pass the ball inside, and it was home and hosed. And Billy Byrne's somehow getting his fingertips to it when he had no right to. It's decisions, it's attitude. That there's just something quite special about the environments in Wasps and in Ulster at the moment.
Yeah, when you talk about the coaching of McFarland. So Edinburgh were comfortably the better team in the first half.
Yeah.
And this is one of the best stats I've seen that demonstrates this in the game. I can't give credit, unfortunately, because I can't remember exactly where I saw it. But in the first half, Ian Do made 98 metres with ball in hand. In the second half, he made 3 metres with ball in hand. So the change, that just epitomises the change that happened to Ulster, which nullified Edinburgh in that second half. And that, you can only really credit that to McFarland for getting them in and tweaking whatever he tweaked in terms of set piece and defensive line.
Well, both teams do beg the question, this is Wasps and Ulster now, like, what is it that makes a great rugby team? Because, you know, it is fundamentally players, right? I mean, we all know it is players. There's obviously something else in this mix which allows teams to thrive, and I think that's kind of the golden question, really.
Well,
because
I think we can do that by saying, what is it that Exeter are doing so well? Because they're the model for every other club.
And in answering that question, and looking to the game that Exeter played against Northampton Saints this weekend, what are Northampton doing wrong? Because Northampton have got quality right across their 50, right across their 23, right across their squad. They've got a guy who I really like in Chris Boyd, who talks a lot of sense. And I've seen him do brilliant things with my beloved Canes. And whatever they're doing at the moment, it is just not working.
Yeah, I think they're now done for the season. If they weren't done last week, I think they are now.
Agreed.
But I think the future's still fairly bright from next year. I don't think it's like a terminal decline. I think they're in good hands.
It's interesting. So with Wasps, they had no line out last week. They had no scrum this week. Some of those have been issues for Northampton lately, but they just find a way. They found a way to work around it. And I think actually, it is that even guys that they pick up from the Championship Wasps, even guys that are youngsters, 20-year-olds like Tom Willis, either they're empowered, either they've been coached to and brought up being able to, or they feel confident to make decisions on the field and take responsibility. And it was watching Dan Bigger just gradually look around him and go,
now what?
What are you doing? Because you've got a guy there that knows the right, whatever level Dan Bigger plays at, he'll take responsibility. But it just felt like there's not that same sense that other players are grabbing the game by the scruff of the neck at Northampton.
I was just gonna say, Northampton, they probably played 60 minutes of this game as the better team, apart from the first 10-15 minutes where they were caught cold. They then got into the game and they scored some lovely tries, and their backs seemed to tick at the right time. But when the pressure came on, and when Exeter, as Exeter always do, when they scored that try, Tom O'Flaherty goes over from 2 yards with 8-9 minutes left. Northampton then just looked clueless. And it's guys like, so you've got Bigger, Courtney Laws, Owen Franks, who are hugely experienced international and high quality players who should be leading that team. And I don't want to single any of them out because I can tell they're all working incredibly hard, but something's not quite there and they couldn't do it against, this is still a very good Exeter team, but this is not their first choice team.
No. So back to the initial question, like, what is that other thing? I guess it's what Leicester Tigers don't have. And that's like the team molds the players. So I never really think of Exeter of having any star players, despite the fact they've got Gray and they've got Hogg, because they just mold into Exeter players. And I think that is probably the thing. If your team is reliant on quote-unquote star power, you must have player X, Y, Z playing in order to win, you're probably doing it wrong. If you are like Exeter, you know, and then the team molds the players, then you're probably doing it right. And even with Saracens, I know they had as many stars as you can, you know, point your fingers at. At their height, it was the team that was all important. It was the team making the players, not the players making the team. Although some people would argue counter to that, I guess.
You were saying earlier that, like, it's got to be the players, hasn't it? I don't think it is. I think all of the teams we've just mentioned, Ulster digging deep and doing it. Yes, the players are out there on the pitch doing it, but I do think this is, and you're going to hate this, I do think this is culture, mindset, coaching. I think it's all of that in the melting pot together.
I've always believed in culture. I just don't believe in a certain type of culture. You know, I believe the Navy SEALs have a culture, but I don't think that they're writing stories to their mothers on their weapons. You know, so you know. So I do believe in culture, just not the sort of culture that we're told to believe in.
Yeah, well, I love the culture. There was that brilliant piece before the Exeter game on the coaches. They're setting the tone and setting the agenda, but giving a lot of responsibility to the players.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And they do drink a lot too, and that helps.
Yeah. And was it in Dylan Hartley's book? He mentioned he threw Exeter under the bus a bit. He went, I won't say which team. I wouldn't want to do that. But there's one team that do naked bus trips home after away games. I won't mention the team, but safe to say, they enjoy their drives back to Devon.
Good for them. We all enjoy a good naked bus.
You're not allowed to say that. It's 2020, JB. You're not allowed to enjoy nakedness.
Yeah, I am. Broughton Park is the worst for naked buses. Were such much of a naked bus team?
Every now and again. Every now and again, we'd have a big old booze on the way back.
You were allowed to opt out. Like even Broughton Park, you could opt out, couldn't you?
Very rare.
You'd be looked down upon.
Yeah, you would be looked down upon. Well,
you have to sit at the front. Except for one guy once. One guy, right? About 6'4". Good player, bit of a sense of humour malfunction quite often. Unbelievably, came with us to Carlisle, and whilst we all bought beers, he bought his work laptop, and then proceeded to get his work laptop out on the way down. Sorry, the way back from Carlisle, whilst everyone was drunk and naked, and do spreadsheets. I've never seen anything like it. But he wouldn't move. He would not be moved.
That's a strong-willed man right there.
Yeah. I deleted him. Deleted him off my speed dial, though.
To be fair, I was studying for a lot of time while I was also playing rugby, masters and MRICS, and I often worked on the way down to a game before the game, but then I'd normally like to relax and have a beer or two on the way back.
Exactly, you can't work on the way back. On the way there, you know, it's fine.
Get it done.
Some of those long Manchester bus journeys back. Well, same league as you were playing in, Phil, like the national one. To Barking from Manchester into Redruth, and oh my word.
Yeah, National One as a 16-team league when there's five London teams, two up in Newcastle, two down in Cornwall, several in Gloucestershire, and it was just every other weekend was a six-hour, eight-hour, 10-hour bus
80 minutes of rugby, and the rest of the weekend was a total write-off because of port and cheese nakedness and
fortunately for me I was normally injured for half the season, so didn't have too many of them to worry about.
Every cloud, eh?
Right, well, we're jumping around a little bit here, but we should talk about the new Champions Cup format. What do you make about this?
God.
And Phil, can you explain it in a couple of sentences?
Nobody finds this difficult, do they?
I don't understand what everyone's getting their knickers in a twist about saying it's complicated.
I don't either. It's so obvious. I mean, I don't... How? Maybe when you write it down, it takes a little bit of brain power. But when you actually see it, of course it makes sense.
It does make sense. I still find it a bit weird, the whole thing. Because the whole thing, it only drops one round out. Mm-hmm. There must have been a simpler way to only drop one round out of the tournament.
Oh, well, I think the reason it's probably ended up like this... is because one party wants to drop many rounds and the other party probably wants to add many rounds for some inexplicable reason. So, or they just couldn't agree with it and said, fine, we'll compromise on one.
Okay, right. Well, just so briefly, I'll try my best to just explain it in case you haven't seen it.
I'd like JB to explain.
Yeah, go on. Yeah, actually, that's a great shout, Phil.
You have, because in my head, it's still pretty complicated. But I'd love to hear your simplification of this.
And have you ever seen, do you remember The Day Today? Did you ever watch that show?
Yes.
There's one scene where Alan Partridge is on it explaining the route to the World Cup final, the American 1994 World Cup final, which I'm hoping that could turn into that. So come on, JB. Yeah.
Right, I'm going to guess up the form of words first. So
just try and riff it off the top of your head. Come on.
Yeah, because I've got nothing in front of me and I'll try and do my best. After you.
In fact, we'll all have 1 minute to try and explain it as best we can. Okay, so I'm gonna get the clock out. You've got 1 minute to explain the Champions Cup. JB, 5, 4, 3.
Not doing it until I see it. Because
what do you mean until you see it? You see, if it's so easy to comprehend, you don't need to go and look at it again. You've got it in your head. Come on.
Bring it up.
Why are you bringing it up? You're just gonna read someone else's words.
No, I'm okay. So as I understand it.
One minute starts now.
Okay. The thing which seems to be complicating it is that they're seeding teams. So you have different seeds of teams, and then when you construct the pools, you just take a team from each one of the seeding groups to make sure that you've got an average amount of quality across all the groups, and that was the difficult bit.
Okay, so how many games do you play? How many teams are in each group, and how many games do you play in each group?
Right, now at this point, I'm going to say that's why I need to bring it up because I need to say it. I seem to remember, was it two groups?
So, Tim, do you want to go?
I'll have a crack. I'll have a crack.
Yeah, you go.
The top 14, the Pro 14, the Premiership, the top 8 teams qualify for next season's Champions Cup.
Yeah.
Based on your position in the league table, that gives you a seeding. The top 2 teams are seeded 1, the second 2 teams 2. Third pair of teams, 5th and 6th, 3rd and 7th and 8th, 4. You're then randomly allocated one team from each country in those seedings. So if it was the top of the table at the moment, it would be Exeter and Sale, both number 1. One of those teams would be allocated to either Pool A or Pool B, and the same for the top 14, the same for the Pro 14. So you have different seeds from different leagues in two pools. Then this is the bit where it then gets... That's pretty simple so far, I think. Now, in terms of fixtures, Sale or Exeter, as top seeds, will only play teams in their pool, so half of all of the teams in the competition, that are not in their own league, so from the Pro 14 and the Top 14, and are seeded four. Whereas Bristol and, well, currently Wasps, in the second seeds, will only play teams from the Top 14 and the Pro 14 that are seeded three.
Yes. So all that is correct. And that what that means is, even though you're in a pool of 12 teams,
yeah,
you play four games, but you only play two teams. You play two teams twice for your four pool games, even though you're in a pool of 12.
Correct.
And the top four from each pool go through to home and away quarterfinals, and then there is straight shootout, semis and final.
So based on the league tables as they either are now or as they finished last season in the case of the top 14 or pro 14, Sale, for example, could have home and away fixtures against Benetton and Toulouse or Glasgow and Montpellier or any combination of those four teams.
Yes. Yeah. Which Toulouse and Montpellier being in tier four,
yeah,
not many tier one teams are going to say thank you very much for those fixtures.
No.
Equally, Clermont are currently in tier three. Yeah. So they could be playing Bristol and Wasps, for example, who should, theoretically, Bristol and Wasps should get an easier fixture.
I'm with you, Phil, in as much as, well, they've shaved off two rounds, actually, not one. They've not shaved off one round. They've added home and away quarterfinals.
Yeah.
So they've added home and away quarterfinals. That's going to be great, by the way.
Yeah, that will be good.
But they have got rid of rounds five and six in the pool stage.
Yes.
I do kind of think that they could have taken the seeding situation, gone with regular pools, but said, all right, Exeter, because you're top seeds, you only have to play seed number two at home.
Yeah, you get the home advantage
potentially
for your more difficult games.
Hang on a minute. Could you, and I think the answer is yes, in a pool of four, could the top seed have only home games?
Everyone travels to Exeter.
Yeah.
They could, and then the second could only play away at Exeter, and then their other two game. So the bottom team always plays away.
Yes.
So basically, the position dictates, your ranking dictates the number of home games you get, with the bottom getting none and the top getting three.
Although I'd be furious if I was an Exeter fan, because I'd want to go to Paris. So the top-seeded team only plays away for the fans.
I mean, we have got the prospect of Exeter v Toulouse or Montpellier, which is going to be something else. And what, Exeter could be at Benetton, JB. You could go and see your beloved Benetton against the Chiefs. Or Sale. Sale could get Benetton.
Yeah. Oh, split loyalty.
not really, mate. I only support one team. That's Benetton, as you all know.
and Auckland Blues.
And, strongly Auckland Blues. Strongly.
So in the positive plus column, I would put that rounds five and six usually have their fair share of dead rubber matches, which don't really are inconsequential. And we're not going to have those because you've only got four rounds of games. Mm. In the negative column, it's exactly as you identified, Phil. Exeter could be in a pool and play. They could have Toulouse and... No, they can't have Toulouse and Montpellier because they won't be in the same one. They could have Glasgow and Montpellier, which, whereas third seeded Ulster could have Scarlets and Wasps.
No, Ulster couldn't get Scarlets.
Oh, they couldn't get Scarlets. They could have Toulon and Wasps.
Toulon or Clermont.
Is it league or is it country? League, isn't it?
It's league.
League.
So you can't play your own league.
Which makes sense.
I see why they've done it. I think the home and away quarterfinals will be electric. I think we're going to have some big casualties out of the pools and not making it to the quarterfinals by virtue of an accidentally lopsided draw because of the way the French league finished.
Yes. Yeah, that is the risk. Because the French league is obviously done. That's the only league that is concluded. They wrapped it up in June or whenever it was.
After 16 rounds or something like that.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting. So this is a one-off, as I understand, as their press release. But it could see changes for future years. Particularly, I think a lot of clubs and a lot of leagues would want 8 teams being put forward to it, so a 24-team competition.
Yeah. Oh, and that's the other thing to say. Based on how you get on in your 4 games, the top 4 from each pool, so as in the pool split into 2 groups of 12, the top 4 in each of those will go to the Champions Cup quarterfinals. Positions 5 to 8 go to the quarterfinals of the Challenge Cup. That won't be home and away quarterfinals.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested to see how it plays out. It does feel unnecessarily complicated to me, but now that we understand it, it's okay.
I see what they've done. I think they could have kept the structure of the old way, but found a clever way to use the seedings to get rid of one round of games. But
yeah.
Hey. Well, go for my only home or only away version. Mm. We've got 4 fewer games, I think.
Well, I think my way was meant you have the right number of rounds, because that way you only have 3 games.
Yeah, but then you could then have home and away quarters and home and away semis, and that would get you back to the 8 games. Mm. Three pool, and then 5 knockouts.
I don't really understand the home and away semis. Is that just to raise revenue?
It's home and away quarters is what they've done.
Okay.
I assume it's they've. The previous tournament, if you played every single round, was 9 games. We're now on 8. I presume it's to fit in with the calendar for next year.
Yeah. The only other thing to mention with this is where the Champions Cup is scheduled to take place next season. It's going to be just after a round of international matches, and due to the welfare laws that have been implemented, I think in the case of English teams, their internationals probably won't be able to play in some of those games.
Owen Farrell will be free to play, though.
First game back.
Well, this is the big worry for Owen Farrell is, you know, yeah, fine, he might miss the quarterfinal. Yes, he might miss some England games, but the big game away at Ampthill.
Oh. Yeah, of course, we'll have no Saracens, will we?
And do you know where the finals are?
Marseille.
Oh, no.
Which I swore I would never go back to.
There is no chance I'm ever going back to Marseille.
Biggest rats I've ever seen in Marseille.
The worst city. Maybe. Yeah, maybe just the worst city.
That's it.
I'm sure it's got some redeeming features. The weather is lovely, but not a lot else going for it from what I saw.
And the weather was awful when we were there as well.
It was horrendous.
Yeah, I preferred the travelling there to actually arriving.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All of Marseille was the rugby. Like the act, usually I like the rugby and then go for a few beers, go for a few cocktails in Rome. That was delightful. That was incredible. Madrid, rooftop bars, all these things are great. Marseille was garbage.
We didn't really find anywhere to drink, did we? Like, not anywhere good.
No, it was closed and cold and miserable. And,
rats and litter everywhere.
The best thing
about Marseille was the Uber to the airport.
Oh, yeah.
When we jumped in the Uber, because our alarms didn't go off, when we jumped in an Uber 3 minutes after our flight was supposed to depart, and we were 30 kilometres to the airport, and we still managed to board the plane. That was incredible.
Yeah, actually, the one redeeming feature of Marseille were its citizens who, the one thing I did in the back of that Uber, Phil had ordered the Uber. JB had ordered the Uber. Phil was organising boarding passes and stuff just so we could leg it through the airport. My job was to look up on Google Translate what "sorry I'm late" means. And fair play to the citizens of Marseille, who were quite happy to stand aside as we ran through and I was shouting, "Je suis en retard! Je suis en retard!"
What a weekend.
What a shame we might have to go back to Marseille, though.
No.
I don't know why don't the Marseille Tourist Board sponsor us? I've never worked that out.
No, let's go back to Nice and watch it in a bar there.
That's
perfect.
Yeah. How is it so different? How is the experience so different?
Or Rome. I'd go back to Rome in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's it. Away days to watch games in pubs happening elsewhere. Because we can say, oh, you know, Champions Cup final, we've got a podcast weekend, we're going away, Champions Cup final.
Where?
We don't need to say, well, the final's in Marseille, but we're in Rome. Just go Rome. No, they're not going to check, are they?
No.
Result. Right.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
More Premiership action. Good.
Yeah. Just on the Premiership, it was good. It was so good to have plenty of games this weekend that weren't done in the first 15 minutes. Like last weekend's games, almost all of them were non-contests. Whereas this weekend, I think pretty much all of them, maybe not the Leicester Sale game, pretty much all of them were genuine competitions.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. Although, just on the Leicester Sale game, I would like to pose a question and see if you guys think I'm absolutely insane. But Luke James, England or not?
I think he could be. But I personally, I've not seen enough yet of him at 15. But that's partly because I've not watched a huge amount of Sale. And when I have, often the Hammer has been playing.
I mean, I just think this kid's amazing. He made a few mistakes, which is uncharacteristic for him. But he's just such a good player. Everything he does seems to come off, particularly going forward. He had a bit of a nightmare with Nadolo. So there was a high ball over to Nadolo and he didn't compete particularly well. But he managed to bring him down shy of the try line, which is no easy feat. Mm. And just looking at the England 15 options now, Anthony Watson, great. And then... Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. Let's war game England's fullback positions, because who's played in that position recently? Elliot Daly, Anthony Watson... And George Furbank.
Furbank, yeah.
Furbank is not playing as well as he did last year, albeit in a team that is not functioning like it did last year. And Eddie Jones quite often sees things that us mere mortals don't see, and he can spot how a player can work within the type of play he wants to do. But if you were just taking it purely on club performances, then you'd say George Furbank probably won't make the cut.
Yeah, well, just on the Eddie Jones thing. I mean, I have many criticisms of Eddie Jones, which I've been on record as saying many, many times. One of the things I've always been fairly consistent on is he knows how to spot a player and he knows how to spot talent. So I'm sure Furbank will come good at some points. He's very, very good at this. But as if he didn't need to nail it anymore, how good has Rory McConachy been? He has to be back in England reckoning at some point.
Yeah, and can I just say, this is the case for pretty much all professional players, Premiership players. But what a lovely man as well.
He is awesome, isn't he?
He's such a nice bloke.
Yeah.
I chatted to him before the game, and it's rugby players often do this sort of thing, and they're well brought up. But how to make friends and influence people. It's like, yeah, you know, Dale it's Carnegie. like it's like Dale Carnegie, that's it. But like 80-year-old book still stands up today. And it's like Rory McConachy just brings to life all of that. So he'll use your name back to you. He'll always get eye contact, always smiles, always says thank you very much. All those things which take no effort whatsoever. It's just, if I was his mum, I'd be very proud of him.
There you go. But I'm sure Furbank will come good. At the moment, I think that Luke James is outstanding. And I think Steve Diamond probably agrees with me there, who said last week, he's one of the most talented players that he's worked with. Now, I don't necessarily see that, but a glowing endorsement nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. I do like, just to put my hand up for George Furbank, I do like him. I think he's good all round. He reads the game well. He's got a good boot. He's got lovely hands. I do wonder if he's fast enough, like top end speed, fast enough to be an international fullback.
He's not Lewis Rees-Zammit fast, is he?
Wow.
I'm not sure anyone in the league is Lewis Rees-Zammit.
And you called this the other day. You pointed out a bit where he gassed away from Johnny May, and he did it in that try he scored. The way he just accelerates away from Johnny May again, exactly as you called it the other week, it's frightening. He's technically still eligible for England as well.
He got called up but didn't play for Wales.
I would cap, if I was England, I'd cap him. I would do everything that I possibly can.
Same with Hoskins Sototu until he actually pulls on that all black jersey.
Yeah. So trying. Hoskins has he played in the game this weekend for the North. He has been called up to the All Blacks, but he's not yet actually played for the All Blacks.
Yeah. Much like Brad Shields. It's not over until it's over, is it?
Much like who?
Brad Shields.
He's played.
Not for the All Blacks, he hasn't.
Oh, not for the All Blacks, no. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yes, I see what you said, yes.
Much like John O'Ross, JB, he could still play for England or South Africa.
That's a man that you really want playing for England, I would say.
If only someone wanted him.
And just to go on your point with Eddie Jones, we put up a thing on Twitter this week which got a lot of traction, a lot of people following on from our podcast last week about, all right, here's 12 England back row contenders, which six do you pick for an England squad? One name that wasn't on that, which is being rumoured to be picked, is Tommy Raphael from Leicester. Yeah.
There we go.
It's the way Eddie Jones goes.
I definitely do not have enough game tape on Raphael to confirm that inclusion is warranted. But I do have enough game tape on Eddie Jones with talent identification, so I'll trust him, I guess.
I guess Josh Hodge would be the other one, the extra lad. Not because I think he deserves it, just because he's been in and around before. And I wonder if Eddie Jones has just got his eye on him.
Yeah, he's a very talented player. I mean, I've seen him in two games now that are Premiership level. I've seen him several times for England under 20s. And he has some amazing ups. He also has some pretty considerable downs at the moment. And he will level off. He will get more experience. He's a proper talent.
Yeah. I still think an England squad pick tomorrow, it's only two fullbacks and it's Watson and Daly. Simple as that.
Yeah.
I think Watson gets picked as a winger. And I think they're both in the squad, but yeah. Daly and Furbank are still in there. I actually do think Furbank still gets picked. But it's Northampton team. He still looks good, but just not, he's not playing in a good team at the moment.
Daly, to me, seems far more effective on the wing. He just does.
Or at 13.
13 is very good too. But then I think Jonathan Joseph is the best 13 option that England have by a country mile.
Henry Slade.
Oh, Henry Slade's pretty good as well, isn't he?
Yeah, I really rate Slade.
Look, Sam James is going to be the 13 for a team that gets to the Premiership final and arguably is the most important person in that team. Oh, there you go. Yeah. Take both of the James brothers. I think Sam, even though he is more talented, that 13 shirt is stacked, whereas I think Luke could quite easily get in at 15.
Yeah, and it's not quite as stacked. I do think, though, going back to what you said, I think it might come down to a choice between Furbank or thinking of Watson as your secondary 15 and getting someone like Ollie Thorley.
Oh, I know you're talking. Ollie Thorley is such a good player.
He's irresistible. He looks like an international too, doesn't he?
He got called up in... He was in the squad in the Six Nations, but didn't play. But he does look like an international because he's tall, athletic, broad shoulders, narrow waist, big thighs.
Loves contact, but can gas around people if he chooses to.
Oh, he can do yeah, he's so strong, but he's so fast.
He's the opposite to Billy Burns.
Yes, he is the opposite.
And actually, opposite to Luke James as well, because he does not, when you get up close to him, like at the AJ Bell or some such thing, he's not a big man. Not a big man at all.
Yeah, Thorley is very impressive.
When will Eddie Jones pick an England squad? Do we know?
It's got to happen a month or so before the game. So we're probably, I don't know, 2-3 weeks away from it.
Maybe after the Champions Cup quarters.
Yeah, or maybe... So when does the Premiership conclude? Because we've got four rounds left now, is it? Regular?
Yep, four rounds regular. Midweek, then weekend. And then two more weekends after that with the European games in between. So I'm pretty sure it's first round of the playoffs is early August, first weekend in August, and then the final...
First weekend in October.
October, sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
And then...
Okay.
Yes, and then I think it's Champions Cup final, and then I think it's Premiership final. So it's like mid-August, mid-October.
Yeah. Cool. So yeah, I do wonder if it is after the first round of Champions Cup games are back, the quarterfinals. I wonder if that'll be when we see an England squad.
Right, well, we can delve a little bit deeper into that slightly closer.
As we mentioned, Hoskins Sototu. Did either of you see the North v South game?
No, not my.
No, tell me about it. I didn't get to see it. Well, what were you going to say, JB? Not your bag.
I was say not my thing. I thought that's not quite entirely true. I was just a little bit too busy to make time for it.
You both would have loved it.
Why?
So for several reasons. Partly because we all loved Super Rugby at Aotearoa. And this was like filtering down. It was distilling all the best bits of Super Rugby Aotearoa, the best quality players, all playing, like we've said it before, but Super Rugby Aotearoa was basically All Blacks auditions. This was the next step towards All Blacks auditions. And it was a game on a knife edge. And it took until the 82nd minute with an incredible pinpoint cross kick from Richie Mwunga to Will Jordan, two of the stars of Super Rugby Aotearoa, to win the game for the South. It was a superb game all round. There's so much talent on display and so many good things. Like the scrums were massive, lots of the set pieces were awesome. Some of the skills, the offload and the handling and the pace from everyone, backs, forwards, it was just class. I absolutely loved this game.
So are you trying to tell me that the All Blacks might not be a spent force?
if anything, this has like honed the All Blacks. This period of time where they have been practicing their skills, playing against each other, steel sharpened steel, they've just honed themselves to an incredible point. This whole period has been brilliant for New Zealand rugby.
Yeah, well, it has, because it's put it on display. People like us have actually watched it. We've appreciated the quality. And when the All Blacks finally leave their island or islands, they're going to be formidable again.
They are. And when you look at the All Blacks squad, to pick up on what Phil was saying, they've got all the players you'd expect to be there. A couple that have missed out, like Scott Barrett in the second row. Is not involved in this squad.
Yeah, I think him and Retallick are both injured, aren't they?
Yeah, they're both injured. But a lot of unbelievably talented young players. You mentioned Will Jordan. He's a new man in the squad. Caleb Clark as well. They're the two in the backs. And there's five new caps or uncapped players in the forwards. Hoskins Sototu being one of them. Colin Grace, I didn't really see a great deal of him, actually. Tell me about him, Phil, in the back row. And they're just, it's like England. They've just got back row players all over the shop.
Yeah, well, second row, back row, because you've got Quinton Strange from the Crusaders. You've got Tupu Vai and my boy, Asafa Aumua.
Oh, yeah, you called that. The hooker, he looks awesome.
Who's so explosive. Who's... the Canes played him as kind of 1A, 1B, him and Dane Coles. And both of them are pretty explosive. They're both pretty handy. Asafa Aumua is short and stocky and so powerful, hard to stop when he's close to the line. They've got some serious...
One person who's not made a squad is... what's his face? Christian Wade.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Out of the Buffalo Bills.
I'm a bit confused about this. Does this mean he's been released from their squad, or he can still be called into their practice squad for this season?
Oh, I mean, they can sign him back at any time. I think he'll have to clear waivers, and then once he does, anyone can sign him.
The thing that did confuse me slightly, it's not quite what happened with Christian Scotland-Williamson or Alex Gray, who went through this NFL player pathway process and were able to be an extra player on the practice squad for their team for several years, which is exactly what Christian Wade was last year. He was on the practice squad as an extra 18th player, which the other sides didn't get, just so that they could encourage this pathway of German, English, whatever players to come across. Oh, hold on a second. Oh. 12 minutes ago, Christian Wade has been handed a lifeline to his NFL dream. He was released by the Bills yesterday as they cut their squad to its 53-man limit for the upcoming NFL season. But today, Sunday, he was named in the 17 players added to the Bills practice squad.
Oh, because do they have to cut him before they can re-sign him?
I think so. Cut him, give other players the chance to sign him. If they haven't signed him in 24 hours, they can add him onto the practice. So he is an extra man on the practice squad. There you go.
Okay, so he's in the practice.
Basically, a non-story.
It was a non-story.
Oh, then it got to us, three English people, who still didn't understand it, and then we read it on Twitter. Brilliant podcasting.
At least I found out. At least we concluded the story. And all the things I was just saying about there's an extra spot normally. I don't understand. That's what's happened.
So we podcasted too early. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. And I just read headlines and didn't read between the lines. You're right. I just went, oh, he's been cut. These rugby pass must know what they're talking about. But no, they don't.
Thing.
On this particular story, they don't know.
So I've got a question for you. Which England winger scored 2 tries this weekend?
McConaughey. Rory McConaughey.
Which other England winger? Oh, actually, English winger, not England winger. English winger.
Which other English winger would it be? Denny Solomona?
Did he score 2 or did he score 1?
No, he scored 1. I'm just thinking through the teams. Ollie Hassel-Collins? No. No. Winger.
Winger. He was the future.
Bath. No, so it's not Bath. It's not Quinns. It's not...
The only other person I can think who scored 2 tries was...
Tom O'Flaherty? No.
Ribbons.
No, he's a winger.
He's definitely not a winger.
Finish.
He can finish. He knows his way to the line.
Hold on, what other teams are there? It's not a Wasps player. It's not Bristol.
Saracens.
It's not Saracens. It's not
Bristol or Worcester.
It's not Sale.
Or Leicester.
Or Exeter.
Or Northampton.
Or Quinns.
Or Bath. Well, it is Bath because it's McConaughey.
Or Gloucester. Thorley only got 1. So there's a, what? Who's left?
Rhys Sammet got 1.
Worcester?
No.
London Irish? No. They didn't score.
There's only one team left. That's Leicester. No,
was it in the French League?
Was it?
Was it Ibatoya?
It was Gabriel Ibatoya.
Oh, there you go.
2 tries on debut. Fair play to him.
Nice.
I had some question marks around this. I wasn't sure if Gabriel Ibatoya would work in the French league.
What league are they in? Is it Pro? I don't like saying that. I sound like a bit of a philistine here. I never feel comfortable saying French words like that because I don't want to be that person who says, "Oh yeah, we just got back from a lovely weekend in Barcelona."
Pretty sure Pro de Deux is right. I think anyway, it doesn't really matter. No, he plays in top 14.
Agen
played Cast.
Hmm.
But they lost 22-26.
But he played well, so that's fine.
Exactly. So I wonder if England will regret this eventually.
He might get a couple of years of brilliant experience, then come back a much better, more well-rounded player. Because he's still only about 22, isn't he?
Yeah, or he could be the new... it could be like Marcel Garvey. Very young, everyone thought this guy's an absolute superstar, and it never quite materialised despite...
Or, Ollie Phillips.
A bit of
a legend over in Stade Francais. But never really made the England cut. Came back to Newcastle, I think. Just never was quite there. Or Phil Christophers, very good at Bristol, disappeared over to France, never seen again. I think David Rees went to France as well.
He had a meteoric rise, Phil Christophers. He was at Loughborough University, and then I think he went and just asked for a trial at Bristol.
He's very good, I seem to remember.
He was awesome.
Very good. When they were Shoguns, then they went down. And if you remember all the talent that they had and what careers all those lads were, all the things that went to do next... Sheridan, Contepomi. Oh. Is Augustin Pichot still involved with the game?
I think genuinely he's not anymore, is he?
He is.
Walked away.
He's involved isn't he involved in oil or something like that, or shipping?
Yeah.
Australian shipping or something like that. Genuinely, I think that might be what he does.
Yeah, I mean, there's just that team was so stacked. I think Gibson played in that team as well, Darryl Gibson.
Yeah. Well, I've mentioned it a bunch of times, so I won't go over it, but that is one of the most humbling moments on a rugby field, was playing a pre-season match for Newbury before our National One season against Bristol, before their Premiership season, when they were the Shoguns, and they had all of those players, and they all played.
Was Gareth Archer there?
Gareth Archer was in the second row with another absolute mute, I can't remember.
Sternham?
Ben Sternham was at number 8.
Animal.
Yeah, and
Julian White, he would have been propping at that time. Maybe
Jason White.
No, Julian White.
No, Julian White. Yeah, I think he was there. Yeah, but they were so freaking good. We kept it to 14-7 at half time. Clearly, they got a rocket up their backside, and we were sort of going, "Well done, lads, we've got through that." And then we got absolutely panned in the second half.
Yeah. I remember they were one. Dings Crusaders were one game away from having Bristol Shoguns, albeit a relegated Bristol Shoguns in the Championship, come to their patch at Dings for a cup game. And if that had happened, that would have been absolutely mental. Absolutely.
Wow!
Because back in the day, Dings used to play the weird little setup in Bristol. It's like you've got Dings, you've got Bishopston, you've got all of these...
Every village in that part of the world was unbelievable. I lived in Bath for a long time, and I went to university in Exeter. Every village in the southwest of England, there's rugby posts. There's like one pub, a post office, and a rugby club. It's amazing.
Well, in Bristol, they had all the clubs on the same fields. So like what you have is like, I don't know, a couple of acres of fields, and then what looked like porter cabins for Bishopston, Dings, there was another... So I'm sure there's three or four clubs on this like one patch of ground. Dings now have got a 3G pitch and all sorts of stuff. But back in the day, the thought of Bristol going there would have been awesome.
Good old Dings Crusaders, mate. Top club, that.
Yep. Very good club. Well, very good club. Nice club. I don't know if they want to be described as nice.
No, they were always a bit nasty. Like,
yeah.
Tough club.
Yeah. Tough club.
One last thing on Ibatoya. How many tries before the British press and Twitter go mental calling for the exceptional circumstances clause to be invoked and him to play for England?
One more try.
One more try.
Try next week and he's got to come back.
Eddie, bring him in. These are exceptional circumstances. He's too good.
Yeah, so I think what will happen, I wonder how long his deal is, because obviously
It can't happen. And it won't happen. Obviously, it won't happen. you're just jesting. But the reason he is there, and I don't begrudge him this at all, as we've spoken about before, he went for a lot of cash, and he's gone for a bird in the hand.
Mm.
Could I stick around on a mediocre, reasonable contract in England and hope to get my England money, or do I go for a big bag of gold in France? Fair play for going and taking it. But good. As a result,
definitely.
No, you know, choices and consequences.
And so he's only 22.
Yeah.
And also, I think he's in a bind because no matter how good you are as a wing, I'm not sure any Premiership team is going to pay over the odds in the future for a winger.
Especially not one who is potentially going to miss 8 games, 10 games a year for England.
Yeah. Let's go with Johnny May as the example, right? Maybe the best winger in England or English winger in England, right? And he's had a major pay cut. I don't think anyone's going to go and say to Ibatoya, right, we're going to match with France, and then come back and now enjoy your England cash. He's got to be so certain of getting England cash that it's basically nailed on to leave whatever he's getting in France. So yeah. I think he's kind of trapped, you know?
It's the old, what's his name? Carl Ferns dilemma. Yeah. Carl Ferns had the guaranteed, whatever it was, big money for Lyon for many years. And there was talk that if he was playing in England, he could get England cash, but he would have to take a 200, 300 grand pay cut to have the opportunity to earn 200, 300 grand of England cash.
And people that realise this, the welfare situation in France is actually a lot better than people think, because you don't play good players away from home. So, he would know that, well, I'm not going to play that away game, or that away game, so I can rest my knees.
Yeah, you just don't. You don't even bother tying up your shoelaces away from home.
Why would you?
Other games that we've not mentioned. Mm-hmm. Bath looked pretty good against Quins. Quins looked good at times as well, albeit the game was probably over before they mounted their fight back in the last 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, I felt Quins got shamed here. I watched the first half of this. I just thought Bath were much, much better. And they are starting to get to a situation now where the coaching is catching up with their talent.
Quins, or Bath, you say? Bath, yeah.
I think that... I didn't think Quins were shamed or had their pants pulled down or anything. I just thought they were just so naive. And so there's just so many errors. It wasn't that they were outclassed or outgunned. They just made really, really stupid decisions. Lots and lots of them.
Quins. What do you want to say? It's Quins. It's what they do.
Only once this season. Whilst I was going through the game, looking at all the sort of stats and stuff and preparing for the match, one that jumped out to me was only once this season have Quins managed back-to-back Premiership wins.
Really?
Yeah.
That is such a Quins thing to do.
The stat which jumped out at me was in the last 50 games, Simmons has played 47 of them. Matt Simmons.
Right, okay.
It does like a lot of games, that, doesn't it?
It does.
Maybe it's not that. Maybe I'll have to. Maybe ignore that.
It is quite a lot of games. Fair play to him.
Quins, we already knew that they were done, but they are extra done now.
But I must say that 2,700 people is all it was in the Quins crowd.
Yeah.
But it made such a difference. And having been without it for a while, it genuinely gave me goosebumps when the crowd cheered as the players came out. It was really special having fans again. And it makes such a difference to the game. And from the players' perspective, it makes a massive difference as well. And so fair play to Quins, because I think they absolutely nailed it. But I couldn't believe it was only 2,700 people. It felt like way more.
Because the noise was generated.
Yeah.
Weren't they letting them in from 12 o'clock in the afternoon in batches?
It didn't sound very fun the way it was done. You had an allocated time to arrive. I don't think it was quite that early. The game kicked off at 2.
Pretty sure it was, because that's what Nick said on comms. So from 12 o'clock, they had batches of people coming in, which I don't know. How do I feel about that? I guess if all three of us went to watch the rugby and we had to be there 2 hours ahead.
Yeah, I don't like being told what to do. Even yeah, if I want to make that choice to be there 2 hours of my own free will.
Yeah, but what else would we be doing? I mean, maybe we've got to explain, look, I would love to help with the childcare, but on the other hand, I've got to get to Harlequins 2 hours early for unexplained reasons.
It did help that it was a glorious day.
Have a little natter, get wrapped up warm. I mean, I'm not saying I want this to happen, but I can think of worse things, perhaps.
I've just missed, as much as anything, I've just missed the raspberry, faded raspberry chinos that people at the Stoop wear. Love it.
And the Maseratis.
Oh, yeah. The cars in the car park are ridiculous at that club.
Yeah.
I don't know which belong to players and which belong to fans, but they're crazy.
Yeah, but I'm 100% with you. It was rather morale boosting to see people back in stadiums, and I hope everyone else starts letting people back in stadiums now.
On the flip side, though, I understand why, but I'm quite disappointed at the way grassroots rugby is at the minute. It's just entered phase D or something, which basically means you can
tackle each other.
You can tackle each other, and you can still play inter-club touch, and you can have 15 minutes of contact.
I don't believe anyone. Right, so I had a good conversation about this with the director of rugby from another local club, and he was very much more understanding to the RFU situation than I was, very much more so. I hate it. I absolutely hate it because I don't believe them. I don't believe them for a second when they say, oh, it's evidence-led. So Chris Jones of the BBC did a really good interview with Bill Sweeney. And, you know, that's what Bill Sweeney was saying. Like, you know, it's evidence-led. We're on the phone to the government every day, you know, and then we take accounts from there. I don't believe them. I don't believe that there's evidence somewhere saying that, yeah, well, COVID transmission in lineouts is negligible, but competitive lineouts, yeah, it's through the roof. Can't do that until stage E. What does that mean? I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and to say that, well, yes, you can scrummage and maul for 15 minutes, but you go over that and the risks become unacceptable.
Yeah.
I'd love to see the study that gathers that evidence. Like, how do you possibly gather that evidence?
It's totally baseless. You're absolutely right.
You just want people to die, JB. You just want everybody to get sick and die.
What you want, JB, is Owen Farrell let loose on a crowd of the public and him just high-shotting everyone.
I seem to remember back in the day when we were told it was to save the NHS. Well, that's clearly been saved now. Can we go back to playing rugby? Or if we're not going to play rugby, at least tell me the reasons why you think a competitive line-out is more risky than an actual line-out, or why 15 minutes is worse than 16 minutes. The other thing as well is, I know this is nonsense, because of all the people that play rugby, it's clear that some people are more at risk than others. So if you're just looking for a risk thing, why don't we say all players with a certain BMI can play, all players with a certain BMI can't play? Why? Well, because they're at more risk. Why don't they do that? I mean, it's so obviously nonsense.
Or why don't we enforce the government guidance that happens on in airports and on public transport and in workplaces, where social distance where possible, sanitize your hands, keep certain groups of people that have to be closer together, and then social distance aside from that, and then let people assess their own risk.
Exactly.
Tim, I think one thing you're advocating there is a forwards bubble and a backs bubble. So, well, no forwards can tackle any backs, and no backs ever have to ruck or maul. And I'm all for that.
That's great.
That is perfect.
Great idea, Phil. Great idea, Phil.
And all front rows have to live in a house, presumably. we have a better front rows, you know, COVID-free front rows.
On a serious point, there are risks always, and I understand you can't eliminate risk. Same as walking on a rugby pitch, you might get someone who tackles you with really poor technique and clocks you around the face when they don't mean to, but they do so recklessly. That's a calculated risk we take. I understand it's a little bit different, but one anecdotal thing that I saw today, which if it's being replicated across the country, which I expect it is, I think rugby could have big problems coming its way. I was on a big pitch in South Manchester today, where all around us there were football pitches with matches being played of kids, adults, all other sports going on. And a number of the guys in my son's rugby team didn't come to rugby practice today because they'd managed to get a football match that they could actually play a competitive game. And I think this could really hurt the mini and junior sections of clubs. And if it does, that's the lifeblood of so many rugby clubs, those subs that they get.
I've been watching cricket for weeks, like competitive kids and age, because there's a cricket club 200 yards from my front door. So I go there for a wander round with the lad. And they've been playing for weeks and weeks at all age grades.
Yeah, I just don't. Like I said before, I just don't believe that the science behind what the RFU are doing is robust in any way. I don't believe that the government scientists must have so many other things in their in tray that when Bill Sweeney phones them and goes, "Yeah, we've got this idea to do competitive lineouts and not competitive lineouts. Is that okay?" They'll go, "Yeah, Bill, fine, whatever." Conversely, if you phoned up tomorrow and said, "Yeah, we're going to play full contact rugby tomorrow," "Yeah, Bill, whatever." I'm pretty sure they've got so many other things on their plate that, you know, they would sign off anything. The lineout thing is nonsense.
Let's just say, for example, how would you feel? Because I know how you'd feel. How would you weigh it up if rugby just went back to how it was and people took their own decision about the risks they take and social distance where you can, but for those 80 minutes on a pitch, you're playing rugby? What would the reaction be, do you think, if someone got very sick and died that had played in a rugby game?
No one ever wants anyone to die, of course.
No.
As many preventable deaths as possible, but I just say, well, you know, it is. And look, I've been on a rugby field, and a guy on the next field basically had to be revived by paramedics from a heart attack. You know, people have been on rugby field and died. They've been paralysed. It's a risky game. No one wants anyone hurt, but by the same token, I'm willing to take the risk.
Yeah, I think a lot of other people are. And there is a point, though, and it's one that we've made before, which is the problem with infectious diseases, viruses, is you're not just taking the risk for you, you're taking the risk of passing it on. And that is something that does need to be considered. And if you live with your sick mother or you're reliant on elderly parents for childcare or whatever it is, you shouldn't be playing.
But that is the option
to be able to play.
That's the choice for an individual that lives with someone who's elderly, and it would be a real shame if rugby's not an option for them. But that's a choice for them.
If you work in a care home, you're not going to be playing rugby anytime soon.
Yeah, I
do think, like, and I've been very cautious throughout the whole pandemic, but kind of now I'm seeing that. I do think that the trade-off, providing it's done in the right way, is right, and we should be able to get more back to normal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well.
I do worry when you look at the, and I understand it's not just to the individual, it's how it transmits and everything else, but I do really think the consequences for rugby, particularly at this time of year, September, schools are going back now.
Yeah.
Parents are setting into routines. Like, you know, with my two, we've sort of set, right, okay, now this is what you're doing at weekends, right? You're doing netball, you're doing rugby, you're doing this, you're doing that. And there's a lot of mainly boys, but boys and girls, obviously, but there's a lot of boys that just want to have some competitive
wrestling,
physical, and they'll do it. Ice hockey's back, football's back, cricket's back, like you say, all these other sports are back. Rugby doesn't look like potentially we're going to actually have meaningful games against other clubs, competitive matches at any level, certainly not mini level, till the new year.
What is rugby league's situation? Does anyone know?
It's a good question. I don't know.
No, I don't know. I can only assume, because professionally they're back, but I can only assume it's just taken the same stance as rugby. But I don't know.
Yeah, because in Manchester, they're organising like a first team touch league. I'm like, forget that. There's not enough money in the world. I'd rather contract COVID than play bloody touch. Like, so no, I'm not getting involved with that. And I don't even want my players picking up bad habits from bloody touch. So you know, that's as close as we're getting. So we're all going to be mixing and touching each other in this awful bastardized game of you know, of the real thing that we all that we want to do.
Even at the top level of rugby league now, they've got rid of scrums for good. Scrums are gone. The COVID was the thing that finally pushed it over the edge, and they no longer have scrums in rugby league.
They've wanted to get rid of scrums for
decades.
I don't know why they didn't do it, actually.
Yeah. Now you see it like that.
Because scrums, in my mind, in rugby league, it was just a restart, but to create space because you suck in, how many is it? 6 from each team. So you've got 12 players within a 4-meter square area.
Now they just
make everyone with the numbers 13 to whatever it is on their back do 10
Yeah. Yeah, we used to do team run-throughs and stuff. And if the times I was playing in the back row, you'd have to stay on your knee. You'd go on a knee when it was a scrum, and you'd have to wait till the ball was gone. The times I was playing hooker, doing the team run-through, we'd have to count to 3 before we could get up and join in.
What could you do to get a rugby league pack to stay still? Or what rule? Like maybe the ref hands both packs a Rubik's Cube and between these 6 players have got to solve it before they can play again.
Just throw 12 pints of John Tetley's or something like that.
Yes.
On there. Tetley's, yeah. John Smith's.
Yeah, they have to neck a pint and you can finish your pint, put it on your head, left hand, obviously, Buffalo, and then you can play.
Yep. Right, well, I'm sure there's games that we haven't spoke about, but if you haven't spoke about your team, I'm sure they did very well and you should be very, 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 very proud of them.
Well done, lads.
Yeah, well done. So let's bring us home.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to think what games we didn't talk about. Not really many.
No, it's fine.
Leinster, Munster, what was a tight game. Leinster just slowly ground them into...
Suffocated
them. It was like a kind of, in Bond films where like Bond's tied to a conveyor belt going towards a circular saw. It was basically like that, but actually Munster just got put through the circular saw at the end.
You know what? If you were a Munster fan, right, it would genuinely be better if you did not say a thing about the Munster game than having to listen to an hour and something of our podcast upgrade of your semi-final. I wouldn't bother.
The only thing I will say about this game is Munster accrued the lowest ever metres run as a team that I think I've seen. They accrued 91 metres run with ball in hand throughout 80 minutes.
That's like Jamie Roberts making 30 carries levels of metres made. Wow.
Yeah.
And I 91
metres.
Oh, don't forget the one.
Don't forget the one. Which is... I've seen the highlights, but that is it's going a bit far to call it a highlights package.
Wow. Yeah,
Well done, Leinster, though, because Leinster are some team.
Yeah. Agreed. Right. You know where to find us. We're here, as I said at the start, and we'll say it again, the only rugby podcast that is there for you 52 weeks of every single year as we come to the crescendo of this season. It's about time, if you haven't already, that you hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Acast, Spotify, you name it, we're there. And he's at Jay Beardmore on Twitter. I'm at Cocker. Phil is lurking. He'll let you know when he wants to see you. Let the boys play.
Let the boys play.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.